Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC Studios, it's Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast. It's Wednesday, April 20th. You know, Russia's invasion of Ukraine has taken our eyes and a lot of American media outlets' eyes off other things going on internationally. And we want to come back to Afghanistan right now for a segment about some really troubling developments there since the U.S. withdrawal. It was 8 months ago, over half a year ago, that the Taliban rushed back in to take control of the country after U.S. troops pulled out. And even though Putin's aggression continues in Ukraine, and of course we'll continue to talk about that, we wanted to take a look at how the situation in Afghanistan has been changing now. One thing is that initially the Taliban said that girls would be allowed to return to schools. A few weeks ago, however, they appear to have reneged on that promise when principals turned away girls until they had gotten, quote, official permission. There are also reports of journalists being targeted, and according to a pair of NGOs, non-governmental organizations that monitor this kind of thing, journalists imprisoned, intimidated, and in some cases tortured. And with over 300 media outlets reportedly closed since the Taliban takeover, that's according to The Intercept, there's a lot of information about the situation on the ground in Afghanistan that's just not filtering out to the rest of the world. So let's learn what we can now with Karen DeYoung, associate editor and senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post, who's on this story. Karen, thanks so much for joining us. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
And maybe we should start a little meta with the quality of the information we're even able to get about the situation there. The Intercept reported last week that journalists have been especially targeted by the Taliban, as I mentioned. They had the stat of over 300 news outlets having been shut down, and they quote the research director of the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, who said journalists that do risk reporting anything that contradicts the Taliban narrative have faced threats, intimidation, and even beyond that, some have been jailed, some have been tortured. So is the Washington Post able to report from or on Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think, this has primarily affected Afghan journalists. We have people there. We have a bureau in Kabul, as do a number of other U.S. and international outlets, and we work very closely with Afghan journalists. You know, I think it's the sort of secret of foreign correspondence. If you didn't have local journalists helping you, you'd be in bad shape. But Afghan outlets and Afghan journalists have encountered a lot of difficulties. As you said, a lot of outlets have closed down, both broadcast, radio, and print. Tolo News, which is the biggest broadcast outlet there, still operates and pretty much works as it did before, but they've had to be very, very careful about how they operate. I think that women on the air are a problem. As you said, a number of journalists, local journalists, have been arrested or have disappeared. So it is a problem, a big problem with Afghan journalists. So far, they have not cracked down on foreigners. I mean, our bureau seems to be operating fairly as normal there.
So, Karen, the Taliban had said that girls would be able to return to school up to sixth grade, or at least they wouldn't be removed from school as they had been able to return, you know, largely during the American presence. But here's what that looked like a few weeks ago when classes were set to start up again. A teacher in Kabul told NPR that as girls entered the classroom, the principal told them, quote, don't come in here until we've got official permission. And when you come back, you have to wear a black face veil, a black chador, and a black scarf, unquote. A Taliban spokesman has said that it's just that they haven't made a final decision about school uniforms for girls. So that was from an NPR story. What's the situation now, as you understand it, weeks after those reports? Are girls still being kept out of school?
Yeah, I think this affects girls above sixth grade. Girls up to sixth grade are still allowed to go to school, to public schools. These are girls sixth grade and above, what they call secondary school there. And the Taliban had indicated last fall that they were working this all out and girls would be allowed to go. And then the education ministry said in mid-March that, yes, all grades and all schools would be open for girls. This was, you know, their school break is in the winter, and so schools were closed from January until the 23rd of March. And so on the 23rd of March, girls above sixth grade showed up for school and were told in the morning when they got there to go back home. And the Taliban subsequently made an announcement and said, oh, we're just still working this out. We, you know, that we've had a problem with facilities. They did say there was a problem with uniforms that they hadn't decided yet. But I think what happened, what we've learned, is that there was a meeting of the Taliban leadership the previous weekend in Kandahar, where they have their headquarters, and there was a split between the leadership, and there were a few who decided that this was not a good idea for girls to go back to school in these upper grades, and the supreme leader agreed with them and said, nope, can't go back. And so they put out this kind of wishy-washy announcement saying, well, we're still working on this, you know, tune in later. But as far as I know, nothing has happened yet.
Now, the U.S. is in an awkward position here, having just withdrawn, but obviously not approving of this kind of thing. The U.S. had been attempting to engage with the Taliban government on some economic issues, but called off those talks when girls weren't allowed to return to school. I see that on an Al Jazeera report. You can confirm that if you have it. And how has the international community's stance toward the Taliban changed? How is the U.S. assessing its policy toward Afghanistan when there's such a humanitarian food crisis there as well, but we don't want to do things that seem to empower Taliban repression? So what kind of decision-making is taking place as far as you know?
Well, you know, this is a real dilemma for the international community and certainly for the United States, which was always the biggest donor to Afghanistan. After the Taliban took over last August, every country in the world broke relations with Afghanistan. All foreign assistance was stopped. And at the time, this was 75% of all the money coming into Afghanistan, 45% of Afghan GDP. So not only foreign aid was stopped, but all reconstruction projects and support for the government, which no one recognized the Taliban government. So you had basically just as winter was approaching, and the harsh winter in Afghanistan, you had no money circulating at all. Banks closed down. There were no imports. There was no way to heat homes. No one was making a salary. Thank you. And so you had teachers, healthcare workers, all of whom are government employees there, sanitation workers were not getting paid, still haven't gotten paid, most of them. And so the economy just completely shut down. And so the international community, as I said, was sort of faced with a dilemma. They had said recognition of the Taliban will depend on several things, whether they form an inclusive government, that is, to allow other groups, minority groups, and women inside the government, which so far they have not done, still an all-Taliban, technically what they call an interim government, but they haven't done anything permanent, that they would stop all relations with terrorist groups operating there, and that includes the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda and several others, and that they would at all levels respect the rights of minorities, and that in particular women and girls. And so since none of these things had been done, but there was very high concern that basically a huge percentage of the population was going to starve to death over the winter, they came up with some mechanisms to send humanitarian assistance in there that would not go to the Taliban. It would just go directly through non-governmental aid organizations supervised by the United Nations, would go directly to the Afghan people. And that's been going on all winter and spring. But still, the banks aren't open and the economy just does not function at all. So the infrastructure is collapsing. And in the absence of any other recognizable progress by the Taliban to achieve the goals or the objectives that the international community set out to reinstate this aid, the sending girls back to school was kind of a big test. It was the one thing that they could do and that they said they were going to do. And so there were lots of things arranged. President Biden said he was going to unfreeze at least a portion of Afghan government assets that were frozen here. The World Bank, which has a multi-billion-dollar reconstruction trust fund for Afghanistan, said it was going to release part of it. Various governments said that they would do other things. So everyone was anxiously awaiting this decision and girls going back to school. And of course, it didn't happen. And so now the international community is trying to decide what to do about it. And they haven't decided yet. Now, the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund start this week their annual meetings here in Washington. And one of the decisions that's going to have to be made is this World Bank Trust Fund. Are they going to go ahead with any of these programs, or are they still going to keep them frozen?
What's the standard that they'll use to decide?
I think they're waiting. They're waiting for the Taliban to make a decision on girls in school. That seems to be. I think it's highly unlikely that the Taliban is going to come up with a new government anytime in the near future. The whole situation with support for or tolerance of terrorist groups there, I think the Taliban has been trying, but they haven't gotten very far. You know, there was, in fact, this week a huge explosion in two schools, boys' schools in Kabul. There's trouble with Pakistan over a kind of rump group of Pakistani Taliban that the Pakistan say have been attacking inside Pakistan. So I don't think that's not going to happen anytime soon. So again, the sending girls to school is the quickest and easiest way for the Taliban to demonstrate that they actually are moving toward making some progress on these commitments, because they're the ones that made the commitments in the first place, that they would allow girls to go to school. And so I think everyone's just waiting for something to happen. And that is the most obvious thing that could happen, but it hasn't yet.
Karen DeYoung with us, if you're just joining us yourself, national security correspondent for The Washington Post. And I'm glad you feel so comfortable on the show, Karen, that you could just sneeze if you have to sneeze. It's a good thing.
I'm sorry.
You know, other people would go, oh, excuse me, wait, I have to go away for a minute. And, our listeners can handle it. It's real life. Here we are. We're two people. We're having a conversation. You have to sneeze.
I forgot about the mute button. So
just cover your mouth, you know. Ruth in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Karen DeYoung from The Washington Post. Hi, Ruth.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good. What's up?
Well, I'm heard part of Karen's presentation.
You're Ruth Messenger, aren't you? Is this Ruth Messenger?
I am.
So I recognize your voice. I didn't get that from the screener. So listeners, some of you know Ruth Messenger was the borough president of Manhattan. She ran for mayor. She was a Democratic nominee against Rudy Giuliani in 1997. Some people probably put license plates on their cars that said, "Don't blame me. I voted for Ruth Messenger once upon a time."
Thank you, Brian.
And now you're involved in work related to this. So why don't you tell people what you're doing, basically?
Okay. Well, first of all, since I left city government, I've spent mostly the last 20 years doing international human rights work. But I called specifically because there was a self-organized delegation, a women's peace and education delegation, seven women from mostly from the New York and Washington area, a range of faiths, literally two Muslims, a Hindu, a Jew, an Episcopalian priest, a lapsed Catholic, and an atheist. And in any event, we have just come back from 5 days in Kabul. We were there. We went there initially, Brian, to welcome girls going back to school. But 2 days before we were to leave, the Taliban delayed that school opening, and we went anyway. We'd love to all be on the show to talk about what we learned, because we talked to NGOs that are providing, non-governmental organizations that are providing services for girls. But we met with the Taliban, we sat and met with the education ministry. And in fact, this morning we had a follow-up phone call with the education ministry, again, pushing them on taking all of the steps necessary to get girls back in school. But also, Brian, we have a second issue. And the second issue is that the United States needs to unfreeze some of the $7 billion of Afghan money that we're holding in the U.S. Federal Reserve, because the country is sinking into despair. Higher levels of unemployment, higher problems with starvation, and that's the way you get a failed state, which nobody needs. Mm.
But Ruth, that's the dilemma, right? That's the dilemma that Karen was just laying out. Do we give money to a government that is doing these repressive, oppressive things, like not letting girls go to school?
Well, so that's, I think, the real issue, which Karen was just touching on, is you can't get any place if you don't talk to people. You know, we're in the middle of Passover. I know that's not everybody's holiday, but I would point out that Moses went to negotiate with Pharaoh. Pharaoh was a tyrant of his own sort, terrorist of his own sort, but negotiating and conversation and diplomacy help. And talking to the Taliban education ministry and saying, this is inexcusable. These girls need to be in school. There's lots of Western interest and pressure. And then hearing from them, which we did today, how many girls are in school, that some women teachers are still being paid, and that there's pressure within their own organization for girls going to school and against girls going to school. So you have to support the people who are pushing on the right side. And you have to also look at the fact that they are right now, whatever you'd like to call it, a regime, a government, the people in power. We are sitting on $7 billion of their money. So no, Brian, I'm not in favor, although some people might be, of saying, here's your $7 billion. But I'm certainly in favor of thinking about what would happen if we said, pick a number. Here's $2 million. We are counting on your spending this on health care, food for those who have nothing to eat, and education. And we're going to watch. And either they do the right thing or they don't. But it's their money.
And Karen DeYoung from the Washington Post, I want to finish up with one final question that's really a follow-up on an exchange that you and Ruth Messenger were just having. There was also an opinion piece in The Guardian from Dr. Aisha Jahangir, which notes the different degrees of coverage that the Western press has given to the situation in Afghanistan compared to the situation in Ukraine. Lately, at least, she wrote, journalists may not be propagating war, but through inconsistent and infrequent coverage, they are also not prioritizing peace. So how do you think, at a policy level, that coverage or lack of coverage has shaped or enabled what the Taliban is doing in Afghanistan, maybe even under direct cover, explicitly in their heads, cover of Ukraine taking the front row?
Well, you know, go back to August, September, October. We were all Afghanistan all the time. And so I think that you know, there's a reason why it's called the news. You know, we certainly gave equally as much attention to Afghanistan then as we're giving to Ukraine now. But those of us who cover Afghanistan, you know, we still have our bureau there. We are still writing stories. I'm still writing stories, even though I'm also covering Ukraine pretty much every day. But the fact is that since this school thing happened, not much has happened to change the situation. It's just gotten worse. And I think there is coverage of that. So it may not be on the front page every day, but I think there is coverage of it.
Karen DeYoung is associate editor and senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for coming on with us. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you again, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.